I call this meeting of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. Our first bill on the agenda for today is House File 2930, Representative Hill. Representative Hill, while you make your way to the testifier table, I'm going to move that House File 2930 be laid over. Representative Hill, to your bill.
Well, thank you, Chair Wolgamond and Co-Chair Rarick. We do have an oral amendment with some kind of late-breaking details that just came to us, so I'd like to offer an oral amendment.
Representative Hill offers an oral amendment. However, a quorum is not yet present, so we would not be able to take any action on that at this time.
Well, let's
hopefully
talk about
by
the
time you get through your presentation, we'll have a quorum, Representative Hill.
Wonderful.
To your bill.
Well, once again, thank you, Chair Wolgamond and members. I'm here today for a brief presentation on House File 2930. It's a bill that is there to help support the crucial work of researching to find a cure for ALS. Most of the folks I've talked to about ALS have a story or a connection to this cruel disease, and I know I do. Today, I'm here for all who suffer from ALS and those who know and love them. As you know, it's a disease that slowly robs those who are battling it of their strength over time. In 2022, this committee made an appropriation of $20 million to support making progress towards finding that cure. Today, we bring a bill to ensure that 2022 investment is used more effectively and efficiently by our leading experts to find a cure. It's important to note here that no new dollars will be allocated today, only shifted to support the work of leaders in research in fighting the disease collaboratively. I'm proud to be joined here today by ALS advocate Dante Tomasoni via Zoom and by the director of the program, the ALS program at the University of Minnesota, Dr. David Walk. Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Tomasoni to share a few words on the history and the spirit of this 2022 appropriation and why this bill will ensure that this historic investment will be maximized to move us closer to finding that cure. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hill. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Wolgamond, I think we're going to start on Zoom here today.
Oh, thank you.
Sorry.
Okay, on the Zoom, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamond. My committee members, my name is Dante Tomasoni. Also, thank you to Representative Hill for carrying this bill forward. As many of you might remember, this was my father's bill, Senator Tomasoni's bill, one of the last accomplishments he made as a senator during his lifetime. And, you know, as he would say, since 1939, when Lou Gehrig's disease is the more famous name for ALS, was diagnosed, almost no progress has been made as to finding a cure for ALS. And so when my father was diagnosed, even prior to his diagnosis, he used to say as a Minnesota state legislator that his goal was always to help as many people as he could. Unfortunately, his fate ended up finding himself helping a lot of people through ALS as he suffered through disease. And so when this bill was passed, it was designed to find a cure for ALS. He wanted to get to a point where no one ever suffered from the disease again. And that is the best way to help anyone who was ever diagnosed from ALS. And he realized that we were in the state of Minnesota with the two best hospitals in the world, with the U and the Mayo. In fact, actually, Lou Gehrig was diagnosed at the Mayo Clinic. And so since this money has been allocated, we've tried to do some work behind the scenes to find out how it's being distributed and the best way to find that cure. And we've worked with representatives from the Mayo and the University of Minnesota. And we found out that the piecemeal studies that have been done using this funding is one of the most ineffective and inefficient. And though they are based in good science and there are great doctors working on them, great applications, and higher ed has done a great job of working with those, there is a better way to do it, a more effective way to do it, to effectively get at exactly what my father was trying to do, was find a cure for this disease. And so with that, members of the committee, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. David Walk, who has been working tirelessly on a plan that would help utilize this money in a way that can certainly be more effective at finding the disease. Thank you, committee members. Thank you, Chair Wolgamond. Thank you, Representative Hill, for allowing me to testify today.
Dr. Wach, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Dr. David Wach. I'm head of the neuromuscular division in the Department of Neurology at the University of Minnesota, and I direct the University of Minnesota ALS programs. I'm very honored to have Representative Hill and Dante Tomassoni working with me in this effort. I choose to work at the University of Minnesota because it is one of the nation's premier public research universities with broad and deep resources in all areas of biomedical science. Thanks to the support of the people of Minnesota, our department is a recognized leader in neurological research and care. Our ALS team is applying technology developed at the university to advance ALS research in the brain, spinal cord, and blood. I've been asked today to testify about the impact of this legislation. 3 years ago, Senator David Tomassoni dedicated the most challenging time of his life to helping others by spearheading legislation to fund ALS research in Minnesota. This appropriation has funded 5 research projects, 3 at the University of Minnesota and 2 at the Mayo Clinic, and we feel that it can do much more. The legislation currently before you will apply the balance of the Tomassoni ALS funding to accelerate ALS research and care for Minnesotans. The UMN-Mayo partnership has a longstanding history of success in advancing research together. We will leverage existing models to build statewide collaboration in research and education while engaging critical stakeholders throughout Minnesota. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of this legislation. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Hill, a quorum is now present. So if you would please present your oral amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The oral amendment, based on information we received just the other day, the bill calls for the shift of the appropriation made back in 2022 and calls for the remaining $15 million to be opened up for this collaboration. What we found was there's a few more dollars there. Currently remaining in the fund is $15,262,263. And the oral amendment would be to amend the amount from $15 million to that amount.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to Representative Hill's oral amendment? Okay. I move Representative Hill's oral amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there any member discussion to House File 2930? I recognize Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to thank you, Representative Hill, for bringing this forward. In my former life as a staffer at the other legislative body in this state, I spent my final year actually as a researcher on higher education, and this bill, this original bill, was one that I followed and tracked. And it really is, it is good work that's happening there. And one of my memories of Senator Tomassoni is when he wanted to be brief, he would always get up and just say, it's a good bill, you should vote for it. So it's a good bill, you should vote for it.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Is there any further member discussion? Co-Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quickly, so it's my memory, Representative Hill, that the only money that's gone anywhere was University of Minnesota and Mayo. Has there been money spent anywhere else besides those two entities?
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont. Representative Rarick, it is my understanding that no, the money has been utilized here in Minnesota.
Anything further, Chair Rarick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I believe it's just those two entities. So what we're functionally doing is kind of taking it out of OHE's control exactly and sort of sending it directly to where it had been going initially, which is the University of Minnesota or Mayo, because it sounds like from the the grants that have been offered already, I think it was 3-1 and 2-the other, maybe 2-Mayo. Go ahead.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont and Co-Chair Rarick. That's one of the reasons why we're excited to have Dr. Wach taking part. Dr. Wach's work has moved consortium work further down the line to bring synergy and to bring collaboration into this this research. I think that one of the things that stands out to me is the amount of money that remains in this fund and some of the challenges. You know, Dante spoke to it, Mr. Tomasoni spoke to it, that some of the research that's been done thus far is operating in almost a piecemeal fashion when we can work more collaboratively to move towards a cure, because our friends and our family members and community members don't have time. And that's what the genesis and the purpose behind this bill is.
Is there any further member discussion? Seeing none, Representative Hill, closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Thank you to the members for allowing us to present this bill. Like I said earlier, I think most of the folks probably around the table here today and in this room and those listening have a story or a connection to this cruel disease. And, you know, I'm usually pretty nervous when I present a bill, but today, walking through that silly tunnel, I was really feeling jitters because I'm thinking of Rose and Chris and Senator Tomasoni, people who I've met along the way that suffered from ALS. And so really appreciate the time and honored to be with you here this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hill. I renew my motion that House File 2930 be laid over. The bill is laid over. The next item on our agenda for today is House File 2561, presented by Representative Bonner. Representative Bonner, while you make your way to the testifying table, I will move that House File 61, excuse me, I move that House File 2561 be laid over. Representative Bonner, to your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We are here first to hear about, House File 2561. In today's rapidly evolving digital technology, Minnesota must be positioned to respond to workforce needs, but more importantly, to lead in developing high-skill, high-impact talent. House File 2561 gives our state universities the ability to offer applied doctorate programs in fast-growing, mission-critical fields, starting with cybersecurity and artificial intelligence, and extending to emerging disciplines like data science, health technology, and quantum computing, as well as digital infrastructure and more. The cybersecurity threats are increasing in frequency, scale, and sophistication. At the same time, AI is reshaping how businesses, governments, and communities operate. We need professionals who not only understand these technologies, but who are equipped to shape their ethical, secure, and effective use. An applied doctorate focuses on solving real-world problems with advanced practice, not just academic theory. In enabling applied doctorates in these and other fields, HF 2561 ensures Minnesota has a homegrown talent pipeline ready to lead at the intersection of innovation, policy, and practice. Applied doctorates are critically important for professionals looking to advance their leadership in industry, government, and education. They support working adults who want to deepen their expertise while continuing to contribute to their sectors. Allowing these programs in state universities ensures accessibility and affordability and alignment with regional and state priorities. So let's cut to the chase. House File 61 expands the authority of state universities to offer applied doctorate degrees in high demand, rapidly evolving fields, not only cybersecurity and artificial intelligence, but also other emerging areas of technology and workforce need. It empowers institutions like Metro State University to build programs that respond directly to Minnesota's innovation economy. I will mention briefly, like the Rarick Hansen bill, which you heard yesterday, this bill builds on that excellent foundation, but it takes it a step further. As we address critical workforce shortages in cyber, the national security of our modern world, all while doing that, standing on the precipice of an AI revolution with quantum computing on the horizon. That is geek speak for buckle up. Tech is poised to transform our lives in ways you cannot imagine, and we must be ready. Finally, one of its best-selling features is that it has the strong support of the entire bipartisan IT caucus in the House and Senate, as well as both chairs of this committee. Members, I would ask for your support of House File 2561. And with that, I do have a testifier here today.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. President Arthur, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont. I am Ginny Arthur, and I'm the president of Metro State University. I was here with you on Tuesday to talk about the other bill and shared, you know, the work that's going on at Metro State in terms of cybersecurity. So I'm not going to repeat any of that. But I do think I'm happy to speak to this idea with a more expansive bill that does give strategic flexibility to your state university. So all of my other six presidential colleagues would strongly be here to support this bill as well. I think the original amendment to the statute, which allowed Minnesota State to offer applied doctorates, was back in 2006. I've been a president for 9 years, and I will say during that 9 years, my colleague presidents and I have talked about the need to open up the statute and the authorization for more applied doctorates. And that just has become critical as we see technology and the workforce needs changing so rapidly. 2.5 years ago, none of us really, or maybe only a few, maybe Representative Bonner, knew about ChatGPT. And now it is changing the world of work in all kinds of ways. I sit on an advisory board with the technology leaders from the largest companies in the state of Minnesota. And all they can talk about is we need an AI workforce. We need to upskill the current workforce. To do that, we're going to need people who are able to teach the certificate programs, associate's degree, bachelor's degree, master's degree, all the way up to the doctorate. And, of course, the applied doctorate helps us prepare the faculty for the future. But again, we can't foresee all the changes. Representative Bonner listed some of the things which are right on the horizon. And, we can't wait for 20 years to have something that really impels us to come back and ask you to take your time to add one more to the list. So we hope that you will support this bill, which includes that broader authorization for applied doctorates. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Members, is there any discussion to House File 2561? Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would note that this is, I'd say, vastly different than the bill that Representative Hansen and I had, because that was contained to just cybersecurity. And I don't have a problem with it, yes or no, but I would like to hear from the broader audience. I don't know if we have somebody from the University of Minnesota here that could speak as to their thoughts or what the institution would, do they have any concerns about this? Because this is expanding it to possibly doctorates that they already do. And the statute was sort of carved out, as you know, you had noted that in, I think it was 2006, you said, that different parts of the statute were kind of carved out, like, okay, you get this piece, and you get this piece, and you get this piece. And now we're taking, because the language is so broad, frankly, it says literally any doctorate you want to do is what it says. So now that could be anything that the University of Minnesota does. So not that I personally have a problem with it, but I would like to hear from them and maybe even Penn State as to, what their thoughts are and why we... I wasn't here back in 2006, so I don't know what the legislature was kind of envisioning at that point, but it's pretty clear that there are specific buckets of all of those things that they go into. So I think we've got somebody from Penn State that would like to come up, and I would like to hear from the University of Minnesota, too, if they would like to offer their either approval or support or concerns.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. I just need a little clarification on the question. I'm not exactly sure what you're asking. So in order to hear the response, I just want to make sure I understand the question. Is your concern is that too many institutions would be able to offer these programs?
Chair Rarick.
It's not too many. So if you read the statute that's in the bill, so it talks about, you know, Minn State gets to do this, the 2 years get to do this, and it's very definitive who does what. When you get to the doctoral level, there are specific things that Minn State's allowed to do, and there's a whole list. So it's you get a doctorate in education, business psychology, physical therapy, audiology, nursing, and the bill that we had was adding cybersecurity. So my concern is when we start changing those things, I know that Mr. Oman probably has some history on this. I wasn't here back in 2006. But my question is there concerns at the University of Minnesota that now Minn State would be in competition with them?
Perfect. Got it? Thank you. That's what I wanted to make sure I understood.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. Sorry, Chair Wolgamott. That's what I wanted to make sure I understood the question. Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. Before we go to the testifier, I do want to be clear that, and certainly we'll let the testifier speak, but I want to mention that, you know, when we talk about things like AI and cybersecurity, there are really only a handful of schools that can do this. And really their desire to do this is driven by the demand of employers and workforce and so forth. You know, they also have limited resources and have to be sure that whatever they're going to offer, that the demand exists. And I can tell you that there are thousands and thousands of open positions across the country that we cannot fill. So, and part of the problem is that we don't have any teachers to teach those programs to get those folks in the pipeline. So I just want to be clear that that is the case. So there probably wouldn't open it up significantly in that there's really only a handful of folks who can actually do this work. But with that, I'll give it to the testifier to take a crack at your question.
Mr. Chair, just...
Chair Rarick.
Thank you. Just a point of clarification. On line 2.2, it says very clearly, and any additional areas determined by the Board of Trustees. So it literally is any doctorate area that they decide to do. So it's more than just cybersecurity, artificial intelligence. It's other emerging practices, workforce needs, but then it literally says, and anything else that they decide. So that's a big change. That's a huge change from existing statute.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will say, I think the intent here was, you know, we like to be efficient at the legislature. And having to come back every single time that there's a giant need like this feels like it's not always something we have a lot of time for in the legislature, you know, to constantly have folks coming back. The intent here was to try and be efficient. But certainly I will be upfront with you that if that is a significant issue or barrier for members of the committee, I would be happy to entertain an oral amendment to remove that final part from the bill. And that with that, we should let the testifier speak.
Mr. Oman, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Bernie Oman with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And Chair Rarick, I date myself a little bit, but I was here in 2005 when this language was added in. And it was not without controversy with the University of Minnesota. And in the world of higher ed, we had a fight, which is a bunch of conversations about getting to a place that they felt more comfortable with, and we resolved it by naming specific areas in the applied doctorate world that we would felt that we could participate in. Winona State University, for example, I think is the leader. They have 240 folks that are involved in more healthcare, you know, doctorate in nursing. St. Cloud State, I know, is very involved in higher education leadership, as well as Mankato and obviously Moorhead and Metro State. The initial bill, this dates me even further, but was crafted in 1990, which I was on that side of the table and probably voted for. But the reason is when merger happened, there was a lot of concern about, and I remember the former chair of the committee last year saying, you guys want to make sure you're teaching Chaucer to technical education. And we were able to come up with a language back then that had the different missions written into law. We would support both of the bills. The immediate need is cybersecurity, because President Arthur and the leadership of Metro State is ready to queue that up. We don't have any programs that are like ready to move, but obviously giving the authority to the board from the legislature is really the decision of this committee and obviously the governor. Coming to the legislature, we haven't had a bill or a need to come to the legislature in 20 years, and would really leave it up to you whether or not direction you want it to go. But we're obviously very engaged in this work, and I would just maybe not speak for the University of Minnesota, but in this incremental way, there hasn't been any controversy of mission creep back and forth to the legislature or from the legislature or from the systems. And that was, it really was a significant issue in the higher education community several years ago. So in a quick way, I'm trying to say we support both bills, but we really need the cybersecurity language.
Thank you for your testimony. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Ullman. I appreciate that history. I know you were in this body with us at one point, and you've been with Minn State for a long time, so that history is incredibly helpful. I know we have a representative from the University of Minnesota back in the room, and I don't know if they've heard the conversation, if they have any concerns about opening this up to any doctorate, potentially any doctorate program at Minn State, given that history we just heard.
Mr. Chair, members of
the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, Christine Keel, University of Minnesota Government Relations. We don't have concerns about it, but the oral amendment would be appreciated.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so because there's two parts to it, and I just want to be clear as to what you're comfortable with. So, cybersecurity and artificial intelligence seems very defined. But then after that, on line 2.2, it says other emerging areas of practice and workforce need, which could be anything. Mm-hmm. And then it goes even further and says, and any additional areas determined by the Board of Trustees. So my concern is the everything else. And my recommendation, just to make this very clear, because we just haven't had a whole lot of conversation about this, and maybe the University of Minnesota wants more conversation back, but literally to delete lines 2.2 and 2.3 in totality and just leave it with cybersecurity and artificial intelligence. That would be my recommendation, but I'm open to thoughts from the committee.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Co-Chair Rarick, so is it just not enough to take out line 2.2?
Chair Rarick.
Or is it that that would be leaving out the University of Minnesota?
So if we take out line 2.2 and 2.3, it leaves us with Minn State being allowed to add cybersecurity and artificial intelligence to their doctoral programs, and that's it. I just feel like we need to have more conversation about it. It's just not enough conversation.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Rarick, I agree with you. I was thinking about the same thing. And here's a suggestion. I don't know if when I was reading this, I was almost going to ask when the phrase other emerging areas of practice and workforce need, if that related back to the IT and artificial intelligence. And I think what I heard is that they want a little flexibility in that space. And so I wonder if, and maybe we're not going to sit here and wordsmith it. Is this bill being laid over, Mr. Chair? It is. Okay. So maybe
yes.
That would be more, it could be worked on a little bit if it's going to be part of a bill that moves forward. But my suggestion would be to modify that so it says something like other emerging areas of IT practice and workforce need, and then put a period there.
Chair
something Rarick. Like that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking the same thing. And if it's directly related to cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, That I'm fine with because it's kind of all in the same bucket, but the language became so expansive that I was like, whoa, wait a minute, we're talking about anything and everything. And maybe it doesn't turn into anything, I don't know, or maybe they are the best competitor to the University of Minnesota, I don't know. But, you know, this language dates very far back before most of us were here. Mm-hmm. I think all of us, actually. No, you were here before. Do you? Okay.
Not in here, though.
Very good. So I would be comfortable with that, just having it pertain directly to cybersecurity and artificial intelligence fields.
Representative Bonner, thoughts on that amendment?
Thank you. Again, I just want to be clear. You know, our intent here was to avoid sort of piecemeal legislation and streamline the process to allow state colleges and university board of trustees to approve applied doctorates, not any doctorate, applied in emerging areas. But we would be open to, because this bill is being laid over, having a conversation about limiting that to emerging technology fields in the language, or even removing some of that language if that makes folks more comfortable. Again, we were just looking to try and avoid piecemeal legislation and additional work for folks, but we appreciate the suggestions and concerns and would be happy to work with you on that.
Members, rather than put forward an amendment, we're just going to work on this as the bill's being laid over. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the leaders, the chairs, have already spoken to this. I think we should limit to computing, because computing will cover everything under the technology. So instead of just once we do the artificial intelligence and other emerging areas in computing, will be the appropriate, I believe, to cover everything under the sky for any emerging changes. So that's all.
Further discussion, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually not going to comment on the specifics of the intent of this bill, but I think it's worth, I had the same reaction as many folks, sort of on the opposite side, because I do think we should have the conversation about the piece that we spent as much time discussing about, because frankly, it seems kind of odd to me that we put into statute the specific doctoral degrees that our MnState system can offer. I recognize, as somebody who has a tendency to kick hornet's nest, that I might be doing that just now. But I think that is a worthy conversation to have at some point in the future, if that's the approach we really need to be taking with our MnState system. And I don't, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but I think that's just a conversation worth having in the future.
Is there any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Bonner, closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will just reiterate, you know, I think one of the things that we talk about in most folks are not aware that Minnesota is actually on the forefront and a leader in the technology space across the country. As far as I feel that we are behind at times, when we meet with legislative leaders from across the country, we find out we are actually leading the pack. We are the first in the nation to propose making critical infrastructure or IT infrastructure critical infrastructure in the event of a cyber attack. We are literally the only state in the nation prepared for that. We have led the nation on cybersecurity alerts between schools and universities. We are on the forefront of modernizing our systems in state government to actually work for real people. But in order to continue to do that work, we need the people in order to do it. And this would allow us to have the trainers, if you will, to make sure that that's possible. And we want to make sure that we're not just a great place to live in Minnesota, but we're also a great place to work, and that we can attract top businesses and keep them. If the 3Ms and the Boston Scientifics and the Medtronics of the world don't have those critical workforce needs, they may go elsewhere. But I think we have the talent here in Minnesota, and we've seen folks flocking to Minnesota from the coasts in technology. We have the resources that we can get trained and into the pipeline and ready to go. So thank you for your support, and would love to, if you would support the bill to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. I renew my motion that House File 2561 be laid over. The bill is laid over. The next bill on our agenda is another Representative Bonner bill, House File 1165, Members, we are running about 10 minutes behind schedule. We have a full agenda for today, so Representative Bonner, I ask that you keep your remarks brief. Please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will try to be quick. I'd like to introduce to you one of the state's best-kept secrets, the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority, or MHEFA. In existence for over 50 years, their mission is to shepherd and fund worthy projects to ensure their success using their tax-exempt bonding authority for capital projects. This work expands options for non-government or nonprofit entities in the area of higher education. Their fees are lower than allowed by the IRS and represent a solid value to fund worthy projects that have broader public benefit. They have a proven track record of success borne out over decades of experience. The state agency takes its authority from the state, but it is fully self-funded, meaning all costs for the administration and staffing are paid for out of fees generated by their work. There is no, and I repeat, no cost to the state budget. The agency is overseen by a board appointed by the governor and with the consent of the Senate. They run a tight ship with two paid staff and billions of dollars worth of projects on successfully executed projects. While the agency has toiled away doing great work over the years, in recent years they were approached to use their vast experience for healthcare and senior living projects. But these projects were outside of their scope. They realized there was an ever-growing need for projects that, like their original scope, go beyond the basic capital and meet the greater public good. Which brings us here today. Many states allow similar authority for both education and healthcare. MHEFA would like to seek authority to do the same. So here's what the bill does. First, it changes the name from the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority to the Minnesota Health and Education Facilities Authority. Note, keeping the same acronym, no new stationery, and reflect the newly expanded authority of the work. Second, it expands the scope of the agency to include the ability to finance healthcare and senior living facilities and adds one board member specializing in healthcare. Third, it increases the amount of financing authority allowed by the agency to cover its dual mission, specifically $225 billion to continue for higher education and $275 billion for the new expected demand for healthcare and senior living. In essence, MHEFA is here today to ask the legislature for permission to apply their skills and low-cost capital bonding authority to meet the increasing needs. This is a bipartisan bill in both chambers. It has passed through the Senate in two previous sessions, but both times we ran out of time here in the House to match up with the Senate. And so we are hoping to get that done today and remedy that issue. Members, I'd ask for your support to get this bill on its way. There are also several handouts in your packet that explain in further detail what the bill does and how it operates. And with that, I have my testifier, Barry Fick.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And before we get to the testifier, I will move that House File 1165 be sent to the General Register. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Barry Fick, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Higher Ed Facilities Authority. In addition to what Representative Bonner so ably talked about the agency and the bill, I would point out that from our perspective, we have $1.2 billion outstanding, and last year, thanks to your work and the legislature, our bonding capacity was expanded from $1.3 to $2 billion. We are already hard at work making use of that additional capacity and have approximately $80 million of financing in place for the balance of FIT 2025. So we're keeping good faith with what you have authorized us to do. In addition, Representative Bonner noted that there's no monetary effect to the state, and in addition to that, the state is not responsible for repayment of any of the debt that we issue on behalf of the borrowers. The state's credit rating is not affected by any of the work that we do. The state's capacity to issue debt is not affected by anything that we issue, so we're completely separate from that perspective. So we independently operate. We have a very strong process in place, and we have made additional things that we put together so we can make sure that the financings we do are going to be solid. And we help the borrowers both before, during, and after the financing process so they can maintain compliance with all the complex IRS, federal, and Securities and Exchange Commission rules. We believe we've done a great job. We think this is because of the interest we have received from healthcare authorities and the ability we would have to expand and do great work in both urban and rural Minnesota for small communities in particular. We would ask your support for this legislation, and I would be pleased to respond to questions or comments members may have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any member discussion? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bonner, for bringing this bill. I just want to understand the scope of it a little bit more clearly. So I get it. So we're basically allowing this group to bond for, allow nonprofits to use bonding authority for healthcare facilities. And healthcare facilities is not really defined, because you had mentioned senior living. Someone else mentioned hospitals. Like, what's the scope of what this can do?
Representative Bonner.
That is correct. I think a more appropriate way to answer that question would be for to let Mr. Fick address what types of projects have been proposed, so you can see what they're actually trying to do.
Thank you.
Mr. Fick.
Chair Wilgelmont, Representative. The definition of healthcare facilities included in the bill was put together with the assistance of the Minnesota Department of Health, so it functions exclusively for not-for-profit healthcare entities, which would include such things as health, you know, physical, mental, substance abuse, as well as dental clinics and this sort of thing. So healthcare as defined by the MDH.
Representative Robbins.
So that's concerning. Do they have to be at all licensed by the Department of Health? Like, we're in a huge concerning place right now about licensing sober homes, autism centers. A lot of these healthcare providers are nonprofit and not licensed. So would they have to be licensed by the state in order to take advantage of this bonding authority, or how would that work?
Mr. Fick.
You know, we haven't firmly decided whether they would have to be licensed or not. We would end up working with the Minnesota Department of Health to make sure that whatever entities did come to us for that financing would be in compliance with all state requirements and regulations.
Representative Robbins.
I appreciate that. So I would just have to say I find that concerning. I think it's a good idea, I think, if it was limited to hospitals or medical facilities. You know, that was more defined broadly, but the way it's written now, I'm concerned, especially without the licensure piece.
Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chair, I want to be very clear about this. You can probably tell by the limits that there are very specific limitations that this organization has. They also have to be very careful about picking and choosing the projects that they have, because they only have limited authority. So what that has meant is that over the last 50 years, they have been able to shepherd millions and millions of dollars into worthy projects that have a greater significance to our communities. And they've done so very carefully and have to vet each and every project very carefully. Again, they have limited ability to do this. They cannot take on larger projects. So, for example, depending on what the nature of it is with a hospital, they might not actually have the ability to do that depending on how large the project is, because they only have a limited bonding capacity. So there are already sort of guardrails built in to this that I just want to make sure that folks are clear on that those exist. And we have a proven track record in this organization of doing so. I also want to make sure that it is clear that these are very specific purposes. I think we had in the past the Hazleton Clinic, for example, came forward wanting to expand. This would be things like a long-term care facility wanting to expand its memory care unit, wanting to expand a unit to add additional mental health beds, for example, might be another way in which an entity might choose to use this.
much in the same way we do this for education, when we build a biology lab or a new dorm or something of that nature, it is very specific.
Further discussion, Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get some clarity. If the facilities are licensed by the Department of Health, everything within the Department of Health, they're required to have a license, whether it's hospitals, whether it's assisted living. So the licensure between the Department of Human Services for programs that we offer is different than the programs under the Department of Health. So if this bill is more focused on the Department of Health as written under Subdivision 6, I think that is with every entity that will be considered a healthcare facility will have to have a license, as far as I understand.
Further discussion, Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you very much. And you know, Representative Bonner, last year I wasn't a big fan of this bill, so I just want to thank you for working with me over the interim. Specifically, and I think it may help Representative Robbins as well, the additions on line on page 10.12 to 10.18, and also the provisions on 11.18 to 11.22, which are some of the guardrails that I was really looking for. So thank you very much, and I will be happy to support the bill this year. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to go again. So just would nonpartisan be able to weigh in on the question about the licensing that Representative Norm mentioned? Because I would feel more comfortable if that was the case. My concern really comes in lines 5.27 and 5.28, where it talks about a supervised living facility, housing with services establishment, board and lodging establishment with special services, adult daycare center, day services facility. Those are the ones where I've got some concern. So can you reference if any of those are licensed by the Department of Health?
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, I can't do that, but I can point you to lines 5.5. In the definition of healthcare organization, it does require that the healthcare organization be authorized by law to operate a nonprofit healthcare facility in the state. So they do have to be authorized by law to operate that facility.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the guardrails that Chair Cleavorn has pointed out and the other efforts to tighten this up, but I personally would like to see it tighter myself. Thank you.
Further discussion. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm noticing on here that this bill did not go to health or human services or any of those entities, which they have the expertise. And I know it's unfair to keep asking Representative Liebling a million questions and Representative Knorr, but this bill didn't go
Mr.
there.
Mr. Chair.
It did.
Representative yeah. Bonner.
Actually, it has been heard in health, and it is passed there, and it's also currently laid over for potential inclusion in the health committee. I also want to point out that this is not this bill's first rodeo. It has been around now for three cycles. It has been through now every single committee in both the House and the Senate multiple times, with the exception of health, which it just did that round this year in the House. But it has passed through all of those committees in the Senate now three times. And in the House, it has now made all of its committee stops with the exception of health until this year, because there were challenges getting it in for a hearing, just lots of competing priorities. But it has already been heard in health, and it is currently sitting in the Bierman bill, or the Chair Bierman's bill, awaiting the potential to be laid over for inclusion. We are also hoping to send it to the General Register, because it really has had wide support and been through multiple cycles. But this is sort of a belt and suspenders approach.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm still not well, and I did miss that. I was looking right at it, and I apologize. I did miss that. So that makes me feel a little bit better that at least it went to health, because we often will have bills here in higher ed, and we're like, I don't know, this should probably be in health. And it's unfair because we have two members from Health and Human Services, and we rely on them a lot. So my apologies. I do see it. It was in health. I would just say, just to Chair Robbins' point, I underline the same things of, like, adult daycare centers, day services, some different things, some different facilities that we've had issues with that have come across our desk, basically, in the fraud committee. And so that, I think that's the concern, is that there's that we've uncovered some issues. And so I think that's her point. And if they are regulated, licensed, audited, all of those proper things, that gives us comfort as long as those things are happening.
Yes.
Thank you. My apologies for that.
Further discussion, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the discussion. And probably the part of the reason, and Representative Bonner is very polite to not say this, but part of the reason it probably hung around so long was because I wasn't comfortable with it previously and didn't want to hear it in health. And Chair Cleburne also worked on it, and I've learned more about it. I think the problem that it's had is that it is sort of an unfamiliar entity to us. And what's really unfamiliar is kind of the way it does its work, and it's something that none of us ever heard of until it came here wanting to change its authority and so on. But Representative Bonner is correct. It's been around a long time. Lots of people have now seen it. It did clear health. The one thing I would ask maybe Representative Bonner or your testifier to just say, if maybe you already said this in this hearing, but the money that is being loaned, is it, I know you said this is not the state's bonding authority. So it is not anything, it's, even though it's financing, it's not really our financing. But the question I have is, like, what money is being used? Could you just really clarify that? Because I think that might help here.
Director Fick.
Yes, Chair Wilgamont, Senator or Representative Liebling. The money comes from, we as an authority are a conduit issuer. So we will go to the public market and or the private bank market, if that's appropriate, and then we will get the lender to provide the money on the strength of the institution or the borrower, not on the state and not on the authority. So the borrower is really the sole person responsible. Our primary role, in addition to making sure that the money will be repaid, is to provide generally tax-exempt financing, which allows them to get at a lower rate, and we provide a stronger process and follow-up as we go through. So the money comes from individual or mutual fund investors, and those are the ones who look at that borrower, not at the authority and not at the state. So that's where the money comes from.
Right.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer. So I hope that sort of helps alleviate some of the concern. And the other thing that Chair Cleburne here asked me to note, since I have the floor, is the online 10.14 in the bill. So the language now requires the authority to obtain consent by resolution from each city or town in which the project is located, except consent need not be obtained from where it's a population less than 100,000. So there is some also control there on which projects are being selected. So thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, just wondering, do you have a rate of default that you could share with us?
Mr. Fick.
Chair Perry-Wolgamott, Representative Scott, zero.
Very good. Hard to beat zero.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Bonner, please give us some brief closing remarks.
Well, we thought this was going to be an easy one, Mr. Chair. But I appreciate all of the really good questions and the exploration here. Frankly, this bill, actually, Representative Davids and I worked on this originally. It's actually been around more than just the three terms that I've had it. But we are delighted that we have finally gotten through the process, and hopefully we can get this moved to the General Register. We can get it out of here. But quite frankly, I do want to reiterate that one of the really strong parts about this organization is not only that they self-fund, which is brilliant for our budget, but really the real value here is in the ability of the organization to very carefully vet each and every project, to make sure that it has community appeal, that it meets the needs of our communities, and really shepherd those borrowers through literally every step of the process. And as you mentioned here, and I was going to bring up in my closing, they have a zero default rate in over 50 years. That is pretty astounding. And with that, Mr. Chair, we would be delighted to have you move the bill to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. I renew my motion that House File 1165 be sent to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and House File 1165 is sent to the General Register. The next bill on our agenda for today is House File 421. While Representative Hansen makes her way to the testifiers table, I will move that House File 421 be laid over.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I lost my pen.
Representative Hansen, welcome to your committee, the Higher Ed Committee. Please proceed with your bill presentation.
Thank you, Chair. House File 421 will ban legacy admissions to colleges and universities in Minnesota and recommend that the region stick by their 2023 decision to end this practice as well. Legacy admission is the practice of giving preferential treatment in college admissions to an applicant based on their family's legacy or history with the institution. Legacy admissions are like DEI admissions or affirmative action admissions for the children of those who are exceptionally rich and usually white. We emailed some documents to you, including a letter of support from the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, a helpful report that's from Education Reform Now on the future of fair admissions, and an article from the Center of the American Experiment expressing support for the bill. And I also included for you a copy of the conversation that Senator Umu Verbaten has been leading in the Senate on this bill for years. I am among the 68% of Americans spanning across partisan lines who are aligned with people like the Center for the American Experiment and believe that it is time for this practice to be prohibited by law. My hope is that by the end of my comments, you'll join over two-thirds of Americans who support ending this archaic, rotten-rooted policy originally enacted by racists and anti-Semites to keep Black and Jewish people out of what they saw at the time as their, but publicly funded, universities 60 years after the Land-Grant Act of 1862 established universities like Cornell, Rutgers, Penn State, and more. It wasn't until 2021 when Colorado was the first state in the nation to ban legacy admissions. That was followed by Maryland, Illinois, Virginia, and California in 2024. This preferential treatment gives a small fraction of American children and young adults a handout that gives them a leg up in the competition for admission against lower income students. In 2023, 30% of Harvard grads were legacy admissions. Historically, 70% of Harvard's admissions were of white applicants, which triggered civil rights lawsuits that you've likely heard about. 40% of the nation's 3,000 colleges consider legacy as a point of preferential status in admission. And 3 out of 4 of the top 100 research universities and liberal arts colleges do too. Nearly every welcome and graduation speech at these schools that are famous for this kind of preferential treatment includes a claim that everyone belongs there and that they were chosen from the masses as the best and the brightest. Yet, 1 out of 6 of these students are from the richest 1% of families. And these 1 out of 6 are 34% more likely to be admitted despite having the same and sometimes worse test scores than their middle-class competition. What's worse is the kids that come from the top 0.1% of wealthy families are twice as likely to be admitted to Ivy League schools as compared to kids that are from families that are just regular rich or middle class. And even if these students found and knew that they were capable of getting into these colleges on their merits alone, the mere sight of their surname, their references, or an address on their FAFSA application can trigger a special invisible point system that gives them the advantage over other applicants that can be equal to up to 160 more SAT points. With enough money hoarded to buy 160 SAT points or to hire someone to take the SATs for a prospective student, legacy families could invest in mentoring, tutoring, or coaching to help their child with the skills needed to get admitted on their merits alone and the value of and teach them the value of hard work. But instead, they have too often simply bought their way to the front of many lines for many years. The benefits of preferential treatment for kids of wealthy families follows them into the workforce, too. While less than 1% of Americans will get into an Ivy League school, their graduates, miraculously, make up 12% of the CEOs at Fortune 500 companies. Over a third of Americans with a net worth over $100 million are legacy admissions, and 25% of U.S. senators are legacy admissions. So one has to wonder, without a legacy admission, where would their journey have landed them? And also wonder, where would the journey of those without legacy privileges have landed them? So how did we get to the bill before you today? As I touched on in my opening, legacy admissions sprouted as an intentionally anti-Semitic and racist policy during the Jim Crow era to intentionally keep Black, Jewish, Native, poor, and non-Native born people segregated from the university under their belief that those who came from families who had the privilege to spare funds as donations to the schools deserved preferred access to benefit from the educational opportunities at the and the prestigious degrees that came from their universities. And this persisted long after the Land Grant Act passed at publicly funded universities as well. Legacy admission is an ugly relic of the past that remains embedded in the bedrock of our higher education system to this day. The battle for civil rights offered some course correction, and President Johnson's executive order to implement affirmative action specifically tackled the inequity that legacy admissions had intentionally produced. Unfortunately, despite our shared privilege of having a clear 2020 hindsight into the past, the Supreme Court unsurprisingly overturned affirmative action in higher education impacting race-based admissions in 2023, rocking this critical tool that prevented preferential treatment from blocking out people who didn't come from rich families. What was meant to be a small but mighty response to correct the course from an ugly past was deleted in the blink of an eye, and our enrollment data today is already exposing the consequences. So that brings us till today. No more history lessons. Thankfully, most schools in Minnesota don't use legacy admissions, with the exception of one university who says legacy admissions plays a very minor role, and they told NPR last year that they don't expect a ban like this to have a noticeable impact at their school. The Regents discontinued this practice at the U in 2023, and we're thankful and support their decision and hope they will stand by that. So why am I presenting this bill before you today if Minnesota hardly ever even does this? Because it's the right thing to do to make our position on equity in admissions the law. Given the Supreme Court's overturning of race-based admissions and affirmative action and the danger, messiness, and slippery slope of the style of governance coming out of D.C. right now, our conviction to this belief is needed more than ever. I don't know if we call what's happening today a plutocracy or a kleptocracy or an autocracy or an oligarchy. Is this despotism? Is it authoritarianism? Is it a theocracy? I don't know. But what I do know is that it certainly doesn't feel like a representative democracy nor a constitutional republic that we at one point could trust. What I do know is that I worry about wealthy Americans' families, about non-wealthy Americans' families' equal opportunities to access something that no one can ever take from them, an education, skills, and a chance to make an honest living. When chaotic governance creates so much uncertainty in society, these fears seem natural. But nevertheless, as this administration strikes down DEI initiatives that were designed to make racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, ableism, and other forms of harm a thing of the past under the claim that any kind of preferential treatment is bad, now seemed like the best time to present this bill as it aligns with the federal government's efforts. I don't have any testifiers here with me today, but I do hope that after hearing about the history, the reason we don't need this anymore, and the fact that we could lead in the Midwest, Illinois already beat us to it, but we could lead with our conviction as one of the best higher education states in the nation and say that everyone will get an equal shot at admissions, not just if they come from rich families. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Members, discussion to the bill. Seeing none, Representative Hansen, brief closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair. Hopefully this gave us a little bit of time back in our calendar. You know, as we're staring down an unqualified billionaire in the White House, I hope that we can keep our eyes focused on our state right in front of us and understand the importance of what our students need us to do, that when the federal government won't look out for their best interests in the coming years, that we will. And that we can tell our grandchildren someday that we're proud of the actions and the steps we took to make sure that everybody has an equal shot, whether they were born into or adopted into a family with or without money. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And with that, I renew my motion that House File 421 be laid over. The bill is laid over. Members, the next bill on the agenda for today is House File 2151. Which I will be presenting, and I will move that House File 2151 be laid over. Members, House File 2151 seeks to establish a plant-based foods production training pilot program to award grants to secondary career and technical education programs and institutions of higher education for the purpose of offering instruction in plant-based food production. Minnesota Farms, Minnesota Colleges and Universities, Minnesota companies, and Minnesota consumers all benefit from the plant-based foods market. Before I go to my testifiers, I'm going to move the A1 amendment, which adds a description of plant-based foods, adds manufacturing, processing, and packaging renovations required, and it adds two points for preference selection. Is there any discussion to the A1 author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Our first testifier is Mr. Daniel Gertner, who I believe is joining us remotely.
Good afternoon, Chairs Rarick, Wolgamott, and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Gertner. I live in Chatfield, Minnesota, and am the lead economic and industry analyst for the Good Food Institute, which is a nonpartisan 501c3 organization that promotes innovation and ensures a level regulatory playing field for plant-based food and other alternative proteins. I appreciate the opportunity to present testimony on House File 2151. I want to share insights on Minnesota's plant protein industry, answer any questions, and encourage you to advance this legislation. Minnesota is a leader in the nation's production of soybeans, corn, peas, oats, and other crops that are important ingredients in plant-based foods. Many company facilities are located in the state, including those of Purus, Eat Just, the Bueller Group, and Cargill. These companies transform plant crops into high-value protein products, providing additional revenue streams to farmers, creating high-paying manufacturing jobs, and advancing our protein security by diversifying the food supply. Plant protein options can also help meet the growing demand for protein and provide alternatives to those with allergies and various dietary preferences. As this sector scales, there is an increased demand for skilled professionals in food science, bioprocess engineering, and food manufacturing. Without a robust talent pipeline, the industry's growth could be stifled, limiting America's ability to meet its food security goals. From research labs to crop fields to manufacturing plants and distribution networks, the plant protein industry could create thousands of high-quality jobs that continue revitalizing rural communities. Encouraging training programs and educational partnerships, as this bill does, will help ensure that Minnesota is best positioned to benefit from growth in this sector. There is a present and growing workforce bottleneck within the plant-based food sector due to a lack of specialized educational programs. House File 2151 is a step toward creating the necessary specialized education by awarding grant funding to Minnesota educational institutions to advance instruction in plant-based food production. Institutions of secondary, career, and technical education and higher education can use the funds for costs relating to equipment, facility renovations, faculty training, and student financial aid. Funding can also be applied toward creating work-based training programs, including apprenticeships and internships, in conjunction with local large and small businesses, farms, and startups in plant-based foods. This public investment in student training will open the door to new revenue streams for Minnesota farmers, economic opportunities for Minnesota entrepreneurs, and a market-based path to increasing the state's food security. For these reasons, we respectfully request that you advance House File 2151 to ensure Minnesota's protein security and reap the economic and job creation benefits of the growing plant-based food sector. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Please stay with us in case there are any questions. Our next testifier is Mr. Hubert. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present testimony on House File 2151, which would establish a pilot program and provide grants to train students in plant-based food production at Minnesota's institutions of secondary career, technical education, and higher education. My name is Zach Hubert, and I lead corporate development at Minnesota-based Purus, which was founded in 1985 and is still today a family-owned and operated business. Purus is the leading ingredient supplier for plant-based products and the largest operating processor of pea protein in North America. We sell pea protein for use in a wide range of food products, such as high-energy bars, bodybuilding mixes, plant-based meats, nutritional drinks and juices, bakery products, dairy products, breakfast cereals, and desserts and ice creams. And we work with farmers and plant-based food makers to support a thriving, sustainable food economy here in Minnesota. In 2021, we opened a $150 million production facility in Dawson, showcasing Purus's commitment to revitalizing rural communities, creating over 100 Minnesota jobs, and supporting local farmers through the plant-based food industry. In partnership with Cargill, we retrofitted a former dairy processing plant into a 200,000 square foot pea protein isolate manufacturing site, which employs more than 100 Minnesotans. We source raw peas from farmers across Minnesota and the Midwest, opening doors for more growers to meet our customers' increasing demand for pea protein. We strongly support HF 2151, which would help build the plant-based food workforce and match companies with the necessary skilled labor to grow their businesses. By incentivizing Minnesota educational institutions to advance instruction in plant-based food production and coordinate with local plant protein producers like Purus, we can develop a critically needed student talent pipeline. Enacting this legislation would not only allow Purus to grow in Minnesota and continue expanding our workforce, it will also attract more innovative businesses to the state. With leading food, agricultural, and manufacturing industries and world-class research institutions, Minnesota has all the ingredients to emerge as a plant protein powerhouse. Investing in the plant-based food industry invests in Minnesota farmers, entrepreneurs, and manufacturers. For these reasons, we respectfully request that you advance HF 2151 to foster the state's economic leadership and educational partnerships. Thank you for your consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Member discussion. Representative Cleburne.
I just want to say thank you for your company's support also of the Forever Green Initiative and working in concert with the University of Minnesota in promoting those plant-based, really good agricultural practices. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Representative Hicks.
I just wanted to say that I am really excited about this. So I am not a vegetarian. I really like meat. I'm a big fan. But I have one of those children who is anaphylaxis to dairy. Is my mic not on? Oh. I have one of those children, like 3% of children in Minnesota that are anaphylaxis to dairy. Not lactose intolerant, throat closed, life end, real bad, poke things in the leg, kind of anaphylaxis to dairy. And pea protein has been a game changer for us for her diet when she was just an itty bitty. So I'm excited to see more of this. She's 10 now, and pea protein remains her largest source of protein. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Is there any further member discussion? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 2151 be laid over. The bill is laid over. All right, the next bill on the agenda for today is House File 2767, which is another bill that I will be presenting. House File 2767 is a bill to increase the maximum grant for the Dual Training Competency Grant Program from $150,000 to $300,000. And as a result, it also increases the maximum per application from $165,000 to $330,000, the yearly grant amount from $6,000 to $12,000, and the maximum for an employee from $24,000 to $48,000. Members, as we heard in committee a few weeks ago during the joint presentation offered by OHI and the Department of Labor and Industry, the Dual Training Grant Program is one of the most effective sources of higher education and workforce development funding available in Minnesota. It is a unique earn and learn model that allows employers to grow their own workforce through collaborative and strategic educational partnerships that directly supports employees and helps them afford the costs of their higher education. This creates a robust learning environment that recruits and retains Minnesota's desperately needed workforce across key industries and supports our institutions of higher education. I am going to present the, before we go to testimony, I'm going to present the A1 Author's Amendment, which removes the appropriation from the general fund. It amends the title, and it makes this a policy bill only with no cost to our higher education budget, which I know you appreciate, Chair Rarick. Is there any discussion to the A1 Author's Amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Our first testifier is Mr. Danny Ackert. Mr. Ackert, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Danny Ackert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I want to thank Chair Wolgamott and Representative Allen for chief authoring and co-authoring this bill. I also want to thank Chair Rarick for her ongoing guidance on the dual training program. She knows a lot about this and has been helpful to our understanding of the program. At this time, the higher education, from our perspective, faces a lot of headwinds. Last year, the Star Tribune reported that for the first time ever, majority of high school graduates are going out of state for their college and their higher education. Subsequently, as this committee knows, enrollment across our state's colleges and universities is at an all-time low. And as more Minnesotans are hitting the barrier of increased costs to higher education, and this is preventing them from either entering school or going back to school. Using the most up-to-date job vacancy data at the Department of Employment and Economic Development, MHA estimates that there are currently over 25,000 open jobs across all the eligible occupations and industries available to participate in dual training. Over 16,000 of those vacancies are in healthcare alone. And I know that the program is not necessarily geared towards filling open jobs, but that demand for those jobs is where this program is so effective and in such high demand. And so for 10 years now, the dual training program has been a source of success in higher education that continues to grow year over year, and more growth is needed. Demand often exceeds supply, and the current grant amounts sometimes limit participation in the amount of support available for student employees. The legislature should seek to enhance the leverage the program as far as possible to directly support working students and begin to fill the vast amount of open jobs across our state. As such, the proposed dual training grant amounts increases will do just that by boosting the coverage of rising higher education costs for student employees in the program, allowing more student employees to participate in the program and advance their education and careers with financial support, and drawing down more employer matching dollars to directly support their employees achieve their educational goals. The increase in matching dollars will strengthen the public-private partnership required in the dual training program, and it will further enhance the financial impact of the program across Minnesota, allowing the dollars to be stretched further. In closing, the dual training program is one of the most effective sources of workforce development funding in Minnesota. Its unique earn and learn model allows employers to grow their own workforce through collaborative and strategic educational partnerships that directly support students and attaining their higher education degrees. House File 2767 will help Minnesotans better afford the rising cost of higher education and strengthen training and employment capacity at hospitals and health systems, as well as within all other industries participating in the program. Please support House File 2767. With that, I'm available for questions and will now turn to the next testifier.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Abigail Canise, and I'm a nurse and clinical supervisor at Children's of Minnesota. Thank you for having me here to express our support for House File 2767. Children's of Minnesota employs more than 6,000 people. These include doctors, nurses, medical assistants, certified nursing assistants, and a variety of healthcare professionals working to ensure that Minnesota children can get the care they need. My colleagues and I are committed to recruiting and retaining a talented workforce that is representative of the communities we serve. Our work continues to be impacted by healthcare workforce shortages, and the hardest positions to fill require a certification, diploma, or degree in clinical fields. Currently, we are experiencing a critical shortage of medical assistants, and the dual training program has been a vital part of our ongoing recruitment and retention efforts to fill these and other roles by relieving the cost burden of degrees or certifications and providing structured, paid, on-the-job training for employees. We began participating in this program in 2022, and our investment alongside the investment from the state has allowed us to support 34 trainees, with 21 moving into medical assistant and certified nursing assistant roles at Children's Minnesota. We currently have 6 active trainees working in our system, including 5 medical assistant trainees and 1 surgical tech trainee. We hope to hire them as they complete their certification or degree. The trainees we have worked with continue to express how important participating in this program has been to their skill development and career growth, highlighting specifically how confident and prepared they feel when starting their new role. As leaders, knowing we are taking part in training future staff has truly provided hope. Without this program, we might not have these wonderful individuals providing care at Children's Minnesota. Additional investments in the dual trainee program, specifically increasing the grant amount for each trainee, would allow us to further reduce the tuition burden, making the program accessible to more employees and supporting our ability to continue to provide excellent care for our patients and families. Thank you, Representative Wolgamont, for bringing this important legislation forward, and thank you all for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Member discussion. Chair Rerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of thought that your team would have more to say because when we had dual training up before, they were concerned about big players, corporations using this. And so there's one thing that we could do to get at this, which is to revert back to the way it was a decade ago when I put it into law. Moving the 25% employer match back to 50%, I think that would also get at this. So I just want to kind of get that on the record that we could also make that switch. And I'm wondering if the testifiers could let me know, like, we're doubling all of these amounts, and if they could explain what the impact of this change would be, because it's a pretty significant change.
Mr. Eckert.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Rerich, thanks for the question. When we looked at what the current limits were potentially not allowing for the program to support, we thought doubling would give a wide enough berth for all potential use of the program across all industries to be covered if that was what the employers were seeking. And so our intent is to allow for the demand for this program to be realized by all employers that can use this program, and doubling was the clear space we thought that could meet or at least allow for either existing trainees to have more of their costs covered or to allow for an employer to have more employees in the program.
Chair Rerich. Chair Eric. All right, is there any other member discussion? Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, and this is just my comment. As these become more and more on the job programs and not through the institutions of higher education, I think we should really think about this program being moved to the employment committee as opposed to, or the workforce committee as opposed to higher education. But that's all I would have to say about that.
Fair point. Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Further member discussion, Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I think the discussion about moving to DEED, there's the program that is called Minnesota Partnership Program, which actually provides the same level of trainings to employers and working with higher education institutions, which is primarily paid through the Workforce Development Fund. So that program already exists in a sense of providing training for individuals within the state and supporting employers in collaboration with higher institutions or other nonprofits who provide on-the-job training. And I think we need to evaluate how the two, because some of the dual training program is also funded by Workforce Development Fund. So I think we need to be looking at how we can streamline that process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further member discussion? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 2767 be laid over. The bill is laid over. Thank you to the testifiers. All right, members, the next item on our agenda for today is a presentation from the Loan Repayment Assistance Program of Minnesota. Members, just so you know, we have about 10 minutes for this presentation, and then we'll have one more bill from Representative Katizawatun. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dee Baskin. I am the Executive Director of Loan Repayment Assistance Program of Minnesota, also known as LRAP, a nonprofit founded in 1991 to provide funds to reduce the education debt burden of public interest lawyers who represent low-income clients seeking legal services throughout the state. It can be very challenging for legal aid attorneys to manage household finances while making their student loan payments, which makes it difficult to recruit and retain skilled people in these jobs. One of our success stories is attorney Daniel Morris of Central Minnesota Legal Services, an organization with offices in St. Cloud, Wilmer, Anoka, and Minneapolis. Dan says that LRAP helped him rework his budget to purchase a more reliable vehicle after his old car broke down several times while driving throughout the Central Minnesota Legal Services 21-county service area. The state's investment in our work, which is $1,100 per attorney, helps each attorney serve about 200 low-income Minnesotans each year with legal needs related to housing, family, disability, and more, and to stay in this work long-term. We thank this committee and OHE for your continued support of our program, and I am happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Member discussion. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say thank you. I mean, $1,100 to serve 200 people is a pretty good return on investment for the state. And not to mention the fact that oftentimes the attorneys are already working for far less than they would receive if they worked for a different type of client. So I just want to say thank you for this work, and I really appreciate what you do. So thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Knorr.
No, I didn't have any discussion.
Oh, okay.
I was standing off the...
You got to be careful. You turn that button on, I'll think you want to be called. Okay.
Yeah, I was standing.
Any further member discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Baskin, closing remarks.
And I just want to say again, thank you to the committee. I don't want to drone on because I sent 200 pages for you to read. I don't want to have you sit through all that. So just thank you for your support of our organization.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentation. Members, the final item on our agenda is House File 2908. It's my understanding that the chief author of the bill is on her way to this committee as we speak. So in the meantime, we will take a brief recess. Members, I'm sorry to spoil your recess, but now that we have a quorum, we... Yes, not as much fun as elementary school recess. Members, I'm going to ask if Vice Chair Coulter has had the chance to review the minutes from our April 1st, 2025 meeting and if he would be willing to move their approval.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have the chance to review the minutes, but now I can't find them in our giant stack of papers. So I will move approval and ask Grace if I missed anything.
Vice Chair Coulter moves the approval of the minutes from April 1st, 2025. Is there any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes from April 1st, 2025 are approved. All right, members, now you can get back to recess. Call the committee back to order. Members, out of respect for everyone's time, we will allow with testimony on the bill, even without the presence of the chief author. So I am going to bring House File 2908 before the committee, and I will move that House File 2908 be laid over. The first testifier on the bill is Aaron Martin. Please proceed with your testimony and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott, Chair Rarick, and members of the committee. I'm Aaron Martin, and I serve as the Policy and System Transformation Director at Youth Prize. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 2908, the Mini Kids Act. During the 2023 legislative session, Youth Prize received a one-time $500,000 appropriation to engage Minnesota communities in designing child savings account models and make recommendations to build the statewide model. Through this work, we partnered with organizations in Rice County, Hennepin County, and Central Minnesota to bring together parents, businesses, and young people to envision how we can collectively invest in children's futures. The result was strong support for a statewide child savings account program that would help families build wealth from birth and increase post-secondary access for all Minnesota children. You can see more information about the support for this program as highlighted in research from a nonpartisan firm, which I encourage you to review in your handouts. You'll also see that you have several letters of support. These letters represent just a fraction of the organizations that support Mini Kids. At the bottom of the one-pager handout, you'll also see lots of logos from different organizations with the time constraints that didn't have an opportunity to submit a letter of support but have participated in our cohort or in our coalition trying to get this bill passed. House File 2908 builds on the work we've done since 2023 by establishing the Mini Kids program statewide, ensuring that every baby born in Minnesota after July 1st, 2026 receives a 529 savings account with an initial deposit, $50 for all babies, $100 for babies from low-income families. The program, which would be housed in the Office of Higher Education, would receive birth data for an eligible child from the Department of Health and set up the account for eligible children within 90 days of their birth. These accounts will grow through family contributions and state incentives, helping pay for college, technical training, and apprenticeships. Research shows that even small savings accounts drastically increase the child's likelihood of pursuing and completing post-secondary education. Kids with these accounts that even have $1 in them are 3 times more likely to enroll in college and 4 times more likely to graduate. Beyond education, many kids is an investment in Minnesota's economy. A skilled workforce is essential to our state's economic future, and this program lays the foundation for long-term prosperity by ensuring more young people can access training and higher education. I urge the committee to support this bill, not just as an investment in education, but as a strategy for economic mobility and community wealth building. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Katisa Watun, welcome to the House Higher Education Committee. Please proceed with your bill presentation for House File 2908.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much for your patience. I ran here, as you all know, we're in the depths of budget discussion. So today I am bringing House File 2908 before the committee, which will build on the great work that we did in 2023 to pilot college savings accounts in several regions around the state. As our initial testifier began, we have other folks here to discuss the progress that has been made on that work. This bill, the Minnesota Kids Investment and Development Savings Account, seeks to build on that work and will allow Minnesota to create a 529 savings plan to help children and families build savings toward their future, college, technical school, apprenticeships, and more. These accounts would be opened by the Office of Higher Education for every baby born after June 2026, that July start date that my testifier mentioned, and accounts will grow through family contributions, incentives like savings matches, and those savings help pay for qualified higher ed or secondary education costs. So I will allow my testifiers to continue talking a little bit more about the discussions that we've made over the last 2 years and some of the public input that we have used to build this proposal for ongoing savings.
Thank you. Welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Leandra Estes. Thank you to Co-Chair Wilgamott and Co-Chair Rarick and members of the committee. I am a mother of three, ranging from the ages of 3 to 23. That being said, I've had one who I sent off to college just on a partial scholarship. Her journey began with that scholarship and ended because of not having the funding and not having things like a college savings account. I have a 18-year-old who is going to graduate this summer from St. Paul Public School. She is going into trades, engineering, and we are hopeful that we can get her through, but again, we did not and do not have a college savings plan. I also have a 3-year-old who is beginning his school education career, and I am hopeful that he is going to be successful and he is going to make it. He's going to have a very bright future. It's obtainable, and that is solely because we do have a college savings plan, and that is through College Bound St. Paul. As an advocate for the College Bound St. Paul program, I can tell you it has helped to sustain health and wellness through finances as well as mental well-being. Just knowing that I have that program helping me to save. I am a full-time employed single mom, but I don't make enough money to save for my children. I don't make enough money to save a loan by itself, but to save for college, you know, that's even harder. So the College Bound programs and programs like are needed. They are helpful, and they are going to aid in helping these children's dreams to become their education and career paths, and those education and career paths will become success stories. College Bound for me, it is hope. College Bound is education, College Bound is a career, and College Bound is life worth living and thriving. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I will. And following that, thank you, co-chairs Wolgamott and Rarick and committee. Amy Trombley, I'm with Initiative Foundation and formerly with United Way of Central Minnesota. And really want you to think back about if you had a savings account going into college, did that help? Would it have helped? Right? And we know when we invest early, we get the highest return on investment. And this is a great way for our state to invest in ourselves. And so we've heard a lot of great programs and initiatives today that you're all making decisions on, but we need people to be going into these programs. And so how do we grow the opportunities for Minnesotans to take advantage of higher education and post-secondary opportunities? It's a program like the Mini Kids. So first off, thank you for the investment that you made in 2023. Central Minnesota was one of the communities that received a grant to work harder for the Minnesotans to think about our future workforce, our future economy, our future post-secondary opportunities. And we were able to bring our community together in Central Minnesota's it was key stakeholders, school districts, higher education institutions, center care, who's even here in the room, bipartisan legislators signed off on it, community organizations, economic development organizations, and on and on. And we talked about the opportunities about broad public and private interest that could make a program like this possible. And we know that this is good for all kids of every background to have every opportunity to develop financial literacy skills, community program that brings communities together, an initiative that will help our young people pursue the opportunity for the best post-secondary option for them, because they've been able to make those decisions based on what is able on an individual basis. Community engagement that we had was important, and we helped build the conditions across our community. And we were able to work with a cohort across the state, so Metro in Hennepin County and very rural in Northfield and in Central Minnesota. So we were able to learn from each other as to what would be successful in a 529 plan going forward in all parts of Minnesota and across the region, which strengthened the proposal we have for you today. United Way of Central Minnesota was so inspired by this work and this opportunity to be able to develop and learn about this for Central Minnesota that they are committed to making this program available for all kids within the United Way of Central Minnesota region. And they will do that through public dollars, through private dollars, and through any opportunities. So regardless if this bill passes, what we're proud of in Central Minnesota is that we were able to engage our community because of the investment you made, and it's going to make a better opportunity for all kids in Central Minnesota. But we want an opportunity for all kids across the state to be able to participate in something like this. So this is great for community development. This is great for economic development. This is great for workforce. But this is great for Minnesota and investing in the people that we have here. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for all the amazing work that you do for kids and families in St. Cloud and throughout the state. Is there any member discussion to House File 2908? Chair Rarick.
So I noticed we don't have a fiscal note, but I have some data from 23, and I'm just wondering if we could have maybe nonpartisan. I don't know if they know this or not, but it looks like the first biennium cost would be $11.7 million and $16 million ongoing. And I know it depends on birth rates and such. So those sorts of things, and birth rates have plummeted. But do we have any sense as to what this would cost?
Mr. Savory.
Chair and members, if memory serves me, a fiscal note has been requested for this bill. It's currently pending in the fiscal note system. I'm happy to report back to the committee when that is finished. I can communicate that to both CAs.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I would have is, this is, as was stated, very, very, very similar to the 529 plan. So I'm wondering why we're doing something that's basically the same thing as a 529 plan.
Representative Katizo-Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Between last session and this session, kind of shifted to a 529 model. Originally, it was just children's savings accounts model, and that was done based on feedback from the participants and the community members who, in the three different areas where we ran the pilot, contributed, and they just said that makes the most sense. So I'm open, potentially, you know, if there's a way that we could meld an existing 529 model and potentially contribute from the state level into those existing savings accounts. But one of the distinguishing factors, I would say, Madam Chair, is that this would be an automatic enrollment and situation, because we know that our lowest income Minnesotans are also often, they're undersaved because of their income, but they're also underbanked. And so they don't necessarily have that first step to enroll in a similar program or some sort of savings account. So the automatic enrollment is a big piece of that. So depending on what the regulations are surrounding the existing 529 option for folks in Minnesota, we can definitely explore that.
Other piece that is a little bit different about the way that these accounts would work, would they would be sub-accounts under the 529 program, which would allow things like philanthropy and corporate entities, healthcare, things like that, to make deposits into those accounts on behalf of a family. So if a healthcare institution wanted to incentivize folks to make well-child visits, which is something they're doing in College Mount St. Paul, for example, they would be allowed to make a deposit into that account on behalf of the family.
Chair Eric, was it Representative Robbins or Scott that was seeking recognition? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you,
Representative Katizo-Watun.
Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins, thank you for the question. Yes, so they would be able to use it for public universities, private universities, technical or vocational training. And that would follow the same disbursement regulations, I believe, as an existing 529.
Representative Robbins.
You create the mini kids affiliate, then you create the mini kids implementation grants, and it just feels like we have so many groups that already do this kind of outreach work about college, and we've been trying to streamline some of that as a committee, and so I'm just concerned about creating a whole new layer of grant programs. So I would just like maybe you to work with OHI and think about who already is doing this work. How can we don't need a whole new round of grant programs. So just my comments, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Katizo-Watun.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And Representative Robbins, I definitely appreciate that feedback. I've never, unfortunately, served on the Higher Education Committee, so I know that you all in the room are the experts. And, you know, I think that when we originally brought the idea based on an investment back in 2019 for the City of St. Paul, which was a public-private match. You know, some of the questions that we had on the Early Childhood Education Committee at the time were based on some of those disbursement questions that you brought up. And I think that because of the pilot program and because of some of those partnerships that we've been able to develop over the last couple of years, we have been able to make some of those connections with local organizations who are on the ground and kind of doing some of this work already, and how you know, we can certainly explore how to tighten up the proposal as it stands going forward.
Thank you. Representative Robbins. Is there any further member discussion? Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank the testifier. I mean, you came in and it takes such great courage to share your story and to talk about your children and the need that you have. But I also want to acknowledge the dream that you have for your children. And so thank you very much for being with us and sharing this deeply personal story with us.
Thank you.
It makes a difference.
Thank you. Can I add that I actually learned of the program during birth of my three-year-old. So you mentioned that like there's other programs and things doing this. I am a resident of St. Paul. I've lived here all of my life. Not afraid to say I am over 40 years old. And living here all my life, I've never had any outreach from any programs. And I am a program advocate. So I speak about programming all the time. And I never heard of got any help with furthering education, even having an IEP myself and having a child who has an IEP. Never had no one to point me in the direction of how can I get my children off to college? How does this work? So the program that has come now that was recently introduced is how I got here and how I am hopeful for my now three-year-old to go. So I just want you to keep that in mind that there may be other programs doing the work, but they're not out here reaching out. They're not. And I am involved in programming highly. So, I mean, it could be something like that. But College Bound and Mini Kids is really doing the work. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Katisa Batun, closing remarks.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee, for allowing us to talk through this exciting program and opportunity for our littlest learners as they grow. And I think that we need to continue working on different ways to encourage and invest in kids in Minnesota as they grow. We know and recognize that one of the cohorts, I guess, of our greater population who leave Minnesota and maybe never come back are our young people who are leaving the state for education for a variety of reasons. And I think that this program will help maybe support folks grow, learn, and encourage them to consider coming back if they choose to leave for their education and raise their family here in Minnesota. So I think that, I appreciate all the input and look forward to working together. I know very well as a fellow chair of a committee that we are in a tight spot in terms of investment this year, but I think that we need to continue looking forward to the future and how we can make a better educational path for all of our kids and people in Minnesota. So really appreciate the consideration and look forward to any future feedback and partnership.
Thank you. With that, I renew my motion that House File 2908 be laid over. The bill is laid over. There being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.